Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Disgraced NFL quarterback Michael Vick is getting a second chance. Once the league's highest-paid player, he served 23 months in jail for his part in a dogfighting ring. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell conditionally reinstated Vick on Monday.
I believe he deserves the opportunity to earn his way back onto the field, but he will have to earn it. It is up to him now.
And up to the commissioner, who has yet to decide when Vic can suit up for a regular season game. That is, if any team will have him. Fans and advertisers will have their say, too. We're taking stock of it all. This hour, On Point, the remaking of Michael Vick. You can join the conversation. Should Michael Vick be allowed back in the game? Does he deserve a second chance? What does this story tell us about the business of pro football and ourselves? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And with us from Port Washington, New York, to begin the hour is George Vesey, sports columnist at the New York Times. George Vesey, it's great to have you back on Point.
Hi, nice talking to you again.
Would you take us through the beginning of Michael Vick's career? Just tell us about him and give us a sense of a visual description of what he was like on the field.
Well, he's a big, fast, mobile, aggressive quarterback who can throw and run. He has, I won't say changed the game, but he certainly opened it up, particularly for his team, which chose to use his skills. So he's, if not one of a kind, he certainly is a prototype and was very valuable to them. At some point, there was the identification that he might not be as good as the statistics that they would like in pro football for passing completions and third down. And then the other side of it is, but he runs so well that he was a factor and you couldn't quite work that in traditionally. So he was a huge force, somewhat individualistic. Atlanta lived with him. It died with him. And probably could have gone on a long time if he hadn't gotten himself into all this terrible and deserved trouble.
Thank you, George Vesey. And also with us this hour is Terrence Moore, and he joins us from Smyrna, Georgia. And Terrence is the national correspondent at ALO Fan House. He spent 25 years as a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And there, I guess, Terrence, you had a front-row seat to Michael Vick's career with the Falcons.
Oh,
welcome
yeah,
to the show, by the way.
Yeah, it's good to be here. And yeah, here in Atlanta, Michael Vick was more than a football player. You know, he was magic. He was Superman. He was a savior. And there's a large segment in this community who still hasn't let Michael Vick go. But there's also a large segment that's glad to see him go. And I've never seen a more polarizing figure in my years of covering sports. And then Michael Vick, because you either loved them or you hated them.
Mm-hmm. Could you guys tell us a little bit about his childhood and his career at Virginia Tech? And maybe sticking with you for a moment, Terrence, I know that you're in Georgia and not in Virginia, where Vick grew up, but you also have studied him.
Yeah, no question about it. And you know, the reports are coming out now, and of course getting right to it, that even in, as early in the single digits, he said that he was involved in dogfighting, you know, watching it as nothing else.
So, you mean when he was a kid?
When he was a kid, yeah. So it was something that he says was a part of his culture. And he was very much like a lot of athletes you hear about nowadays, basically raised by his mother and certainly a guy that people identified early on was going to be a star player, and there's a lot of problems with that, because if you're identified as a young player, as a guy that's going to be it, then you have a tendency to have a lot of people hanging on around you, bad influences, and you can see throughout his life, even going to Virginia Tech, where he was a star at Virginia Tech, those type of things kind of followed him there, where he was the guy, and anything that he wanted, he could get, and that's... Basically, throughout his life, he had a problem deciding who was the person, the people he should be around and listening to, as opposed to otherwise.
Mm-hmm. George, for people like me who don't necessarily know all the players in the NFL, you know, where do you put him in the pantheon of people? I mean, you've covered this for so many years. How about not so much his play, but what kind of character would you say he had as a player?
It's hard for me to address character up to the point when he got himself in trouble. He was such a phenomenon, and as Terrence will know, I get to and have gotten to Atlanta quite a bit, but that is somewhat of a local and regional phenomenon, because in, you know, northern Wisconsin you had Brett Favre, and every football team, every pro football team and college team has its quarterback and its quarterback controversy. So he was huge in the region, but he was also huge in the league because of his physical ability. His persona, I don't know that people outside the, you know, the greater Atlanta, Falcon Nation, whatever you want to say, I don't know that he was as big outside it as he was inside. Was he a national figure? Sure, because of his talent. Mm-hmm. And that's me, and I'm not a football guy, so if I missed some of it, I can only say that you regarded him more as a phenomenon for what he could do on the field.
What kind of revenue, either of you, did he generate for the NFL and for himself? I mean, you hardly read about Vic without seeing mention of these enormous endorsement deals that he had.
Well, you know, here in Atlanta, it was huge. I talked to Andrew Young the other day, the former UN ambassador and former Atlanta mayor, and a friend of mine, and we talked about Michael Vick and his influence and a lot of other things for that matter. But one of the things that Andy Young pointed out, correctfully so, here in Atlanta had the largest contingent of African-American fans at their games than any team in the National Football League. And, of course, Atlanta is really huge when it comes to the black middle class. And so just from a revenue standpoint, in that respect, Michael Vick was huge, because when you've got this large African-American, crowd here in Atlanta, and he's able to tap into that, then obviously that's going to be good for the Falcons, and that's going to be good for the league. And even beyond that, whether you're talking about black or white, you would go to an average Falcons game, or just even just walk around the street, and you would see a lot of number 7 jerseys. And then, of course, that was the number that he wore.
Mm-hmm. But that's intriguing, Terrence. I mean, coming from that community, you mentioned Andrew Young, such a big name. I mean, what is the sense of him coming back? Let's listen for just a moment to Vic's apology in August. This is a couple of years ago now. This is after he'd pled guilty to dogfighting charges, but before he learned what kind of sentence he'd be receiving. Anyway, he apologized for his actions, and he reached out to young fans.
I want to apologize to all the young kids out there for my immature acts. And, you know, what I did was very immature, so that means I need to grow up.
You know, we can talk about atonement later and what those words mean, but I would like to know what Atlantans, and particularly African-American Atlantans, felt and feel now about his possible return.
That's a very good question. And again, it goes back to what I said before about him being the most polarizing figure I've ever seen in sports. It's two schools of thoughts there. You've got people who are steadfast against him coming back and just outraged about what he did, and I'm talking about from a black perspective and from a white perspective. And then you've got the totally opposite, where they feel that he's being picked on, that this was nothing but dogfighting, and people are out to get Michael Vick for whatever reason that may possibly be. And it's really split, and there's no in between.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly seems to be exhibiting contrition, wouldn't you say, George?
It's hard for me to judge. I mean, the statements are what they are. If he hasn't figured out by now that a large swath of the population does consider dogfighting to be antisocial, inhuman behavior, then, you know, there's no hope for him. I suspect he has. I suspect his eyes have been opened to some degree. Atonement, at this point, you know, you'd like to think so. More to the question is, what does he do with his life? how does he live if he's allowed, if he gets back into the league, how does he conduct himself? I think these are, you know, more almost practical questions rather than deep within, which I can't find myself to judge one way or the other. But he really has to know what line to walk and to whom he listens. Does he listen to people who say, well, heck, it's only dogfighting, it's part of, quote, the culture? Or does he say, gee, the larger swath of population says you can't go around letting dogs fight each other and then kill them when they don't perform. Most of us, or a lot of us, don't think that's good. So, you know, what he learns internally, I'm interested in, but people learn to cover that stuff or read from a statement. I mean, how can I say it? That statement that you read from 2 years ago sounds like him reading from a statement that a lawyer handed him. And certainly in sports, and this goes beyond any kind of social, racial, economic level, we see an awful lot of young athletes reading reports or statements that their lawyers or their press agents have handed them. So I'm a little bit callous about all that. But does he learn to behave? Does he learn not to do that? That just isn't going to go for the future for him. I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
You know, if I could add something to what George has said, if I may.
We just have about 1 minute, and then you can come back in the next part of our show and continue. But go ahead.
Sure.
Quickly.
And what I was going to point out is what a lot of people don't realize, that's very frustrating to a lot of people who have followed Michael Vick, and this part is not good by any means. You keep hearing people saying that Michael Vick deserves a second chance. Well, actually, this would be his sixth or seventh chance. Prior to the dogfighting thing, Michael Vick was involved with a whole slew of just strange, ugly situations here in Atlanta and beyond. And after each one, he would have the same thing. He would apologize and say that he was immature. Or other times, he would not even do that. But we can get into specifics later about that.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the business of football and the return of disgraced quarterback Michael Vick. Is racism in play in the Michael Vick saga? Let's listen back for a moment to Michael Vick on the field working some magic.
40, 35, 30, 25, 15, 10. Go, Mike Vick!
This is over!
It's over! Yes!
That's the kind of action that made the human highlight films. We're talking this hour with George Vesey, sports columnist at the New York Times, and with Terrence Moore, national sports columnist for ALO Fanhouse. George, what exactly did the commissioner say about Vic and his possible playing again reinstatement?
He's talking about having to earn his way back, that he has the right to play, but that it'll have to happen in increments. He hasn't set any kind of date for when Vic will be cleared. I'm just guessing that if there was some interest in him and a club were willing to speak up for him, that might influence the commissioner to some degree. But do I think he's letting Vic twist in the wind a little bit? I would say so, but it's part of the process. I mean, he's been off house arrest for a couple of weeks, and you just want to see what his attitude is going to be like. And I suspect the commissioner is a political person, as commissioners are. He's probably testing the wind from his perspective to see how much he hears from, the animal lobby, which is considerable, you know, what he hears from them. I mean, if they say they'll never go near the NFL, he has to ask himself, well, were they going near the NFL anyway, and how many people am I talking about? But it's a considerable and serious charge against Vic, and it will never go away. Whatever happens, whoever ultimately says, gee, we'd like to take a chance on him, we need a quarterback, we'll sign him, he seems fine, they're in for a storm, and they have to be prepared for it.
Well, that does bring up the point of what kind of club might want him, or under what, perhaps not what kind of club, so much as under what circumstances could you see it happening?
I would say the circumstance is one torn ACL by a first-string quarterback, by a regular quarterback, and all of a sudden a club looks and says, gee, we've got the kind of blockers, running backs, offensive coach. Michael Vick with 4 weeks of suspension or whatever, if some quarterback got hurt in the first game the way Brady did last year, and I'm not saying it was the Patriots, but some other team that was a little bit more open and quarterback-oriented, suddenly said, gee, we need, Michael Vick would be terrific here, and even if we don't have him until October 15th or, you know, whatever the logical scenario would be, I mean, every football game is 6% of the season. So if you play, if you can get him for four games in December, that's a quarter of the season, and that could get you into the playoffs. And as we know, wild card teams get to the Super Bowl.
Well, someone was talking earlier to me today about wouldn't this bring a team bad PR, and someone else said the only bad PR is losing. But let's come back to that thought a little later, because I'd like to bring in another voice into the conversation. Joining us from Austin, Texas, is Leonard Moore, professor of history at the University of Texas, where he teaches a popular course on race, sport, and hip-hop. And welcome to the program, Leonard Moore.
Thank you.
So what is your take on this? I hope you've been able to listen to some of what we've already been discussing.
Yeah, well, several things, and I'll give you the first one. Number one, we have to remember, I mean, you know, we talk about Michael Vick as if he's a horrific human being, as if he's a mass murderer. And when we talk about the culture of dogfighting, and people want to say the culture, but understand in parts of the African-American community, whether it's the projects, the suburbs, or even, you know, rural areas, dogfighting is a part of the culture. I know many professional African-American males who have pit bulls and Rottweilers, just dogfighting is a part of the culture. So let me say that first. Number two, I think that I think he got bad counsel. I think his counsel was very bad at the beginning. I think if Vic would have came out and admitted his faults and just said, well, hey, this is how I grew up, I think the American public would have been a lot, you know, they would have been a lot more willing to forgive, and he may have avoided jail time. But thirdly, I think also Goodell needed to send a message, because Michael Vick represented what I like to call the new NFL. He had an entourage. He wore jewelry. He was playing quarterback, which historically had been the white man's position, a position of leadership, and he played quarterback his way. And it's ironic how when Michael Vick was playing for the Falcons, people said, oh, he's going to have to learn to throw the ball sometime. But now all NFL teams want a quarterback who can run. They're talking about this wildcat formation. So in many ways, Goodell had to – I think Goodell wanted to send a statement to the next generation of NFL players that some of this behavior won't be tolerated. And Goodell is in a dilemma, sort of like David Stern was with the NBA. Mm-hmm. When your high-profile players are African-American, but the majority of the people who are sitting in the seats are white, then you have a problem. I think Goodell just wanted to police it a bit and, again, send a message to players, future players coming into the league.
Terrence, you talked about fifth, sixth, and seventh chances being extended to to Michael Vick. So what do you make of this, the culture of dogfighting, and we have to understand this in that context for African Americans, be they rural or urban?
Yeah, I personally think that's a little bit overdone, and I'm not the only one. Again, a good friend of mine is Andy Young, and we were talking about this the other day, and Andy Young said he, you know, grew up in the South and what have you. And he said he never saw anybody involved with dogfighting. And I'm saying that to say I think that there are segments of people in the black community who probably were involved with that, but it's not as widespread, I think, as some people may think it may be. That is to say that from a Michael Vick standpoint, obviously, it was pretty huge. But getting back to this point about the fifth and the sixth and the seventh chances, Michael Vick with the Falcons, he was involved in a lot of just really strange situations. There was a water bottle incident at the Miami International Airport where he was arrested because he had a trick water bottle that reeked of marijuana and sort of got out of that. And then there was a stolen watch incident where one of his entourage had stolen the watch at the security check-in place at the Atlanta International Airport. There was an incident where after a Falcons home game, there were some fans booing him at the Georgia Dome, and he flipped off the fans about several times. And it was just like one thing after another. And the reason I bring this up is that after each one of those situations, the Falcons would either alibi for him, or there would be a combination of that, or he would come out and make a statement similar to what he said after the dogfighting thing about how he was immature and he wanted to apologize. So that is partly why I believe Roger Goodell has been so measured in his response, because he's reviewed the case and he saw that these things happened before, so he just wants to really make sure that this time he's sincere.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call. Melissa is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Hello there, Melissa.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a statement. I'm a dog trainer. I work with rehabilitating animals. And here in Detroit, dogfighting, unfortunately, is pretty prevalent. And when those animals come into shelters, you really get to see what this does to a dog. Most of them have to be put down because they are so dog aggressive, they can no longer even be in a home where they would be an only dog. And I worked with the rehabilitation of these animals, and, you know, it absolutely breaks my heart. On the other hand, I feel that we call our jails and our prisons correctional facilities for a reason, which is to give people opportunity to correct their behavior and learn from that. And I guess my opinion at that point is that if it's truly a correctional facility and a truly a correctional experience.
All right. Well, thank you for that. What about that, anybody? You know, you were talking, Terrence, about the other things that had happened in Vic's past, but he does have something else, literally a rap sheet now. I mean, he has served time. And I'm not talking about the fact that he put in the months in prison. Leonard, you teach a course on race, sport, and hip-hop. A lot of hip-hop comes from the, you know, prison culture.
Yeah. And let me give you some perspective. Mm-hmm. Having been around big-time college athletics much of my professional career, I was 4 years in grad school at Ohio State, worked with football players there, a professor at LSU for 9 years, and I've been at Texas for 3 years. So I know the world of big-time college football, and hearing Terrence talk about, you know, the mistakes Vic has made, and I think that just speaks in many ways to the stunted intellectual growth that too many athletes suffer from, and in particular, African-American athletes. And Terrence knows, you know, and something in my class I call, you know, this athletic industrial complex where –
White Say that again. You call it the athletic the industrial
athletic
complex.
The athletic industrial complex, right, where you have a young kid, 9 or 10, in the hood, a white private school will come recruit him, put him on this conveyor belt, and although that kid makes mistakes, it's often swept up under the rug as long as he's generating revenue for the particular school. Then when they go to college, where boosters in many ways run college programs, unfortunately, and so when the young men get in trouble, there is never really an adequate time for these young men to grow intellectually, for them to develop as men. And one of the things we've been big on is trying to surround high-profile African-American male student-athletes at the high school level and collegiate level with African-American male professionals. Because the intellectual growth is stunted. And it is funny, when Vic read that statement, you know, they're always reading something that somebody else wrote. In many ways, it's because they don't know how to articulate it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackie, if I can add to that point, I think Leonard is exactly right as a whole. But I will say this, the disturbing thing in the Michael Vick case, and needless to say, I know an awful lot about the Michael Vick case, and I'll just tell you something personally that I'm familiar with. Back in 2002, and this was Michael Vick's second season in the league, Andy Young and myself, we sat down with Michael Vick, and we talked to him at training camp for about an hour, probably a little bit more than that, about the pitfalls of playing in the National Football League. And even beyond me talking to Michael Vick and Andy Young, there have been several other people through the years. So Michael Vick has had a lot of mentors out there, a lot of people that have told him different various things, including Dan Reeves, who is a former Atlanta Falcons coach, and Dan Reeves is the guy that orchestrated the trade with San Diego to bring him to the Falcons. Now, I mentioned Dan Reeves because Dan Reeves even went so far as to hire different people to work with Michael Vick on his speech, his finances and that sort of thing. And I talked to Dan Reeves 2 weeks ago, and I asked him, I said, When was the last time you talked to Michael Vick? And he said Michael Vick won't return his phone calls.
Hmm.
And that's very disturbing.
Can I follow up on that?
Yep.
I think one of the things when you have some of these young men who come from environments where there are no older males around, there is no father figure, no uncle, no dad in the house, what I found is that they don't know how to interact with men, Terrence. That's what I found. They
right.
feel much more comfortable talking to their entourage or talking to a woman. And even though men may be in their lives who can give them good advice, they just don't know how to interact with a man.
And Vic, we should point out, was raised by his mother primarily and not his father. Let's take another call. Pete is calling from Houston, Texas. Hello, Pete.
Hello. I'd just like to comment on this notion that dogfighting is a part of a culture. I don't feel that's any excuse. I think we could find other cultures or subcultures that would include things like the Ku Klux Klan, and we don't say that that's okay because it's part of the culture. If cultures are engaging in abhorrent behavior, it's the culture that needs to change.
Thank you, Pete. What about that? You know, part of the culture. I feel like this is a moment when I can actually say I know something about pit bulls myself. My sister raised them. I did not like that. She took them to dog pulls where they would pull their weight and compete that way. I mean, what about changing the dogfighting culture?
Yeah, and I think that's something that's generational. In many hip-hop videos, you'll see young men there with pit bulls or Rottweilers. So speaking to Terrence and Andrew Young's point, yeah, it may not be something that maybe older African-Americans deal with, but I would say between 18 and 35, I think it's a prevalent, you know, it's a prevalent part of the culture. And I think what the African-Americans I talk to, what is disturbing is that it's at, you know, we see that in some parts of America, the life of a dog has more value than the life of an African American. And so that's why many people say he should not go to jail, that it was, you know, that the sentencing was unfair. So I think we have to look at it through a racial lens. Hmm.
George, let's bring you back in. I'm keep thinking it's a good thing you've covered both the Vatican and sports in your career, because maybe that's what we need to really understand this case.
The Vatican, meaning religion. I was a religion writer for about 4 years back in the late mm-hmm. 70s, and you know, still like to see things from that point of view that the people I met and I learned. But in Vic's case, I think there is a lesson here, which is at what point society does forgive. I mean, the whole point, as your caller said before, the idea of a correctional facility, and we see that so many times these days with athletes coming back from some kind of brush with alcohol or drug usage, not even talking about steroids here, but, you know, so-called recreational, where people do things, they drive under the influence, they get caught with drugs on them, and at some point they are back in the system of sports. And I have no problem with that at all, and I believe that people learn from their issues. Having done a book on an athlete who went through a treatment center and having spent some time there myself as part of the research, I think people can relearn behavior, can rethink where they fit, and even if they still would like to do a drug or drink or this or that, to say to themselves, not a good idea given the laws and the mores of society. If I want to play in baseball or basketball or whatever the sport is, or Olympics, I have to learn, and people do learn at least to modify behavior, if only for their own good, for being allowed to come back and compete and make money. They learn to modify, and at minimal, if Vic is at that level of self-preservation in the sense of self being himself as a football player who has a limited window of learning, as a statement to say it's part of my culture, I'm going to keep doing it, or it's okay, possibly he's modified his behavior on it, can he then speak to it, can he address it, or at least, you know, in the proverbial sense, just move on and get himself back into his living? I believe in that.
Well,
and I don't know if that's a religious statement or not. But
well, perhaps the point is
to reinvent themselves. Mm-hmm.
To reinvent. But perhaps we're not able to permit reinvention or trust it if we can't see ourselves making the same sorts of errors.
But why not? I mean, people do all kinds of things, and goodness knows, I mean, I don't know much about it, and I'm fascinated. One of the reasons I'm not chatting a lot is I'm fascinated listening to my two colleagues here talk, and I don't know much about dog fighting, to be perfectly honest, but I have seen other athletes come back after doing some pretty horrible things themselves. I mean, athletes and women, athletes and drugs, athletes and money. I mean, lots of things have gone down and way beyond, any one culture, any one race, any one ethnic group. I've seen athletes come back from all kinds of things. And, you know, did they learn a lesson? Were they changed? How much? They wouldn't do it again. But I do believe in rehabilitation in the broadest sense of it. I think
Thanks,
it works,
George.
And I think we have to be part of it.
Good. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're going to have to say goodbye to Terrence Moore. Thanks for being with us, Terrence Moore.
Thank you.
All right. And Leonard and George, stay with us. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about Michael Vick's return to football. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Michael Vick was used to cheers as a player at Virginia Tech and with the Atlanta Falcons. In 2007, he was jeered as he entered the courthouse in Atlanta to plead guilty for his role in a dogfighting operation. Let's listen back. We're talking this hour with George Vesey, sports columnist at the New York Times, and with Leonard Moore, professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Gentlemen, I'd like to take a listener call here. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Jason is calling. Good. Jason's calling from Harwich, Massachusetts.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm a dog trainer and a dog lover, and I've been following the Vick dogs to see that, you know, most of them have all been rehabilitated and rehoused. But I'd like to ask your guests about the double standard that may exist in professional sports, because being a New England Patriots fan, Dante Stallworth was charged with vehicular motor homicide this winter. He ran over somebody's grandmother, and he's going to probably get suspended, and then he's going to go out in the NFL. And
I believe he has been suspended.
He's been suspended, but he's going to come back. But there hasn't been an uproar about that. And even though I'm against dog fighting, and Vick served 2 years in Leavenworth, which is, you know, the punishment for the crime, I think he should be reinstated, and I think he should be given an opportunity to play football again. I'd like to ask your guests how they feel about Vick's case versus a crime like Dante Stallworth.
Thank you.
The Stallworth case is interesting. I'm from Cleveland. I'm a Cleveland Browns fan. You know, Stallworth is currently on the signed by the Browns. But the thing about the Stallworth case, number one, he hit a Hispanic male. I think it was late 50s, early 60s. So right there, the person that Dante Stallworth killed did not appear to have much value in the eyes of the American public. And also, Stallworth was not nearly as high profile as Michael Vick. But your caller does raise an interesting point. Dante Stallworth, DUI, vehicular manslaughter, kills an Hispanic man in Miami, gets 30 days in jail, and, you know, so no prison time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. George?
Well, it's a legal matter also. I mean, I agree with Professor Moore, but I don't think the National Football League can control what happens in the court. I mean, that's a societal issue, a legal issue. Once the man is available, how long do you keep him out? I mean, Vick's been out for a couple of years because he was in jail, and maybe the league gets four or five more games out of him, whatever it does. In Stallworth's case, the same thing. Once a man has been cleared by the courts, does the league make a judgment on that this was a case of a human life as opposed to animals' lives? It's legal.
Tommy is calling from Columbus, Georgia. Hello there, Tommy.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. I have two points I want to make here. I wanted to speak on, I keep hearing a lot of insinuations that maybe there's some, that Michael Vick is being unfairly ostracized because he's black. And I wanted to point out, I wanted to compare him to the Pete Rose situation. Pete Rose gambled on baseball, for example. And he's been banned from baseball for life. And, in fact, just here recently, a couple of days ago, he was banned from the Hall of Fame. And he's a white man. So I think the racial thing is being overplayed from all sides. I just don't think race is involved here. The second point I wanted to make is that I'm a little confused on why we're even talking about this at all. Because, I mean, these people don't work. They just play a game, and they make millions and millions and millions of dollars a year. And why society finds it so interesting whether or not, you know, an ex-quarterback is going to play football again, or why Britney Spears is wearing underwear or not. You know, I'm really confused on why.
Well, I think that goes to whether or not, you know, who should be a dominant figure in American culture. And I don't think anyone could argue that they are not dominant figures in American culture. But what about the Pete Rose situation? Is that a fair comparison, would you say, when you're looking at something like, if you are going to look at this, as you suggest we ought to, Leonard Moore, through the prism of race, at least somewhat? Where does the Pete Rose case come down then?
Well, I think the whole thing about being banned from baseball, I mean, Pete Rose, he can't play anymore, so that's not an issue. So his livelihood wasn't taken away. And I think in terms of the Hall of Fame, I think, you know, in many ways that's still being debated. But Major League Baseball is hypocritical. You can't have his memorabilia in the Hall of Fame, but then not allow, you know, the all-time hits leader to be in the Hall of Fame himself. And back to the caller's first question about race being a factor, you cannot separate just racism and discrimination in American society apart from sport. I tell people all the time, sport is a microcosm of society. And one of the problems we see that I'm a defender of the black athlete, and I go on record as saying that, only I think less than 3% of all sports writers in America are African-American. So what you have often white middle-class sports writers constantly evaluating and in many ways critiquing the lives of black men, sometimes 20, 30 or 40 years younger than them. And one of my frustrations with ESPN and just all sports journalists, in many ways, they set the parameters for the debate. In my class last semester, we didn't debate whether or not Michael Vick should be let back into the NFL. We debated whether or not he should have went to jail at all. But the problem is the journalists, they frame the parameters of the debate, and we can't get at some of the larger questions that, in my opinion, would expose some of the racial context for the story.
Well, you know, you mentioned ESPN. One of my favorite essays in terms of reviewing material for this show was by Jeff McGregor of ESPN, and he has an essay called The Sporting Life, and in it, he has the speech from The Merchant of Venice, the play by Shakespeare, and he says, "I offer the commission the following advice about the quality of mercy not being strained, dropping as the gentle rain from heaven," that particular passage. And he says, "As a spiritual matter," I'm quoting here, "I remind the commissioner that forgiveness is the only possibility here because it is the one act that makes us truly holy." What do you think about that, George? Because you have written about religion. I mean, what about forgiving Michael Vick, even if you hate what he has done?
I think that's an individual choice, and it's one that I'm not going to ask Goodell or the caller or anybody else to make. That's a personal thing. It's very hard to forgive somebody who was involved in something that you think is as unpleasant as dogfighting. On the other hand, I certainly see cultural reasons and social reasons why somebody might have been doing it. To forgive is maybe irrelevant in this case, because what we're talking about is somebody who has the legal right to go back into society and earn a living. And by the way, the caller who called before, who said that the football players don't work, I've been around sports, I mean, I don't want to tell you how long, but I'm in half a century. And this is hard work, and they're the best at what they do, and they bring certain skill sets. Even if they're not prepared for the world in general, they certainly are very good at what they do. I mean, I have great respect for what athletes do, and believe me, it's work. As far as forgiveness of letting people back into the world they know, I think there's a limited time to work in that world, and if they are legally free, it's up to society to forgive them on a legal basis, and I think that's what Goodell is talking about.
Let's hear from Nathan. He's calling in from Des Moines, Iowa. Hello, Nathan.
Hello. First off, I want to say I agree with the professor in Texas about the status of sports journalism today. But my original point was that I think the Michael Vick situation should speak as a commentary on people being released from prison in general. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I see this all the time. Half of my clients that serve prison time reoffend and break their probation or break their parole because they can't find a job again. And when Michael Vick was debating whether or not they were going to let him back into the NFL, I was sitting there thinking to myself about every other client I have. I'm like, wow, Michael Vick is just like them in that he's released from prison, he served his time, and now he can't get a job. And that's why so many people reoffend or break their probation, break their parole, because when they're released, everybody still sees them as the criminal they are, rather than accepting that they've served their time, they've paid their penance, and they won't let them back in and let them make a living and let them get on with their lives.
Well, perhaps part of that is because of how we do feel about people who've offended. And as we were saying, the type of offense, as George is saying, here's something from Facebook that we took, a comment. "I really feel that he, Vic, should be allowed to play, but I would lose a lot of respect for any team that hires him." I mean, that's the double bind, isn't it, George Fessy?
It's a double bind. I mean, I don't know that I would lose respect for a team for hiring him, because my position is that teams have the right to hire him. I think that the problem is that there are people who are even more involved in animal rights, animal safety, than perhaps I might be, and I have great respect for that. Will they be a force in making people not want to go to games or not patronize the sponsor or this or that? Those are business decisions, and I can understand why a team would want to think that. But a team that hired Vic, they would do it out of need, and I really can't demean the need to do that. They see him. He's a great talent, and I suspect he could make some team better. I can't fault a team for thinking that at a point when they need a quarterback.
One wonders what the impact would be on the clubhouse.
I'm just guessing. I've seen an awful lot of characters walk back into clubhouses, and the clubhouse is the essence of democracy. If you can do your job, you're welcome back. I mean, there's all kinds of characters that come back. You know, A-Rod isn't probably the most popular person in the Yankee clubhouse, but he can surely play, and there's lots of other people if they can perform. I mean, white, black, Hispanic, you know, you name it. If they can do the job, they're accepted. May not be liked, but they are accepted.
Joe is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? I have one problem with Professor Moore's comment, dismissing this as a cultural issue, that dogfighting is culturally accepted in the black community. I mean, there's so many things that the public wouldn't necessarily embrace or find abhorrent in many cultures, and to just write it off as a cultural thing, I think, is wrong. But to my main point is, as a police officer, I find that the young, especially African-American community that I police in, there's a lot of young men that look up to these athletes and want to emulate them. And for Michael Vick to engage in the activity that he's been engaging in, the dogfighting and the other nonsense he's been up to, it just sends a message to these kids that, you know, the biggest and strongest win. I mean, regardless of your ethics, regardless of your morals, as long as you're big and strong to perform on the field, you're going to be accepted. You're going to be taken back. And I think it's just time that this cult of personality end, and we start looking at people for their character and not for their necessarily physical ability or physical prowess.
It's interesting, Joe, that you're a police officer and the last caller was a criminal defense attorney who said, look, my clients, once they've done their time, can't get work. Do you think that should be taken into account here in terms of Michael Vick?
Definitely should be taken into consideration, but you also have to send a message, especially to young African-Americans, that, you know, it's not all right. It's not all right to go out there and commit crime and just get by. And across the board, any race should be held accountable for their actions. And should it be held against them upon their release? I don't know. But when you're rewarding these NFL players with the grand sums of money, the television, the notoriety, the fame, this is everything that this kid is dreaming of, coming from a broken family or a family found in poverty. It's everything they hope for. And to see him come out there and just be accepted back with, you know, with, let's face it, minimal consequences, 2 years. You're talking to kids and families that, you know, send away family members for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 10 years, and they come back to the community to nothing. Okay. Michael Vick is coming back to a very prosperous lifestyle.
All right. Thank you, Joe. Do you
can
want
to
take a look at that, Leonard? Yeah.
Yeah, well, to the police officer's first comment about, you know, dogfighting being cultural, that he should know that cockfighting is still legal in two states, Louisiana and South Carolina. You know, and that's where they, you know, they have these roosters and chickens fighting each other with razor blades on the end. So there is some cultural piece there. But secondly, just dealing with the whole thing about black men and young black boys looking up to these athletes, we have to remember that by and large, African-American males are only accepted when they are athletes and entertainers. One of the things I talk about in class is that being an athlete is the only place where an African-American man can feel like a man. They can wear braids, they can wear tattoos, they can have an entourage, you can cuss the coach out and still make a ton of money. So in many ways, black athletes have not created this culture of acceptance that they benefit from. And
don't you think that has changed somewhat or is changing with Barack Obama in the White House?
To a certain extent, but not really, because we can always look at him as an anomaly. And I know some debates in the community, they're saying that, you know, he's half Kenyan and he's, you know, half European. So they say that Obama really doesn't fit into the traditional African-American male box.
Mm-hmm. What about the whole notion of athletes in general, of any race, George, being divorced from the consequences of their actions, not having to pay a penalty that society would have to pay if the same thing had been done by them?
I think it's a broad question, and certainly it's true that athletes are empowered all the way along, starting when they're 8, 10, 12, being recruited to junior high school and pulled in, as the professor said before, being pulled into schools where they may or may not be prepared or comfortable there, but they are given the chance and brought through, that all athletes get the sense, to some degree, I'm not part of the rest of them. I have it different. I got into school. I got this. I got special help on the admissions getting into college. People gave me money under the table and winked at it all along. You know, the cheerleaders were provided. You know, women were provided when I went visiting on a college campus. I mean, it's a whole different world for the elite athlete in this country. And the lessons they learn are that they are not part of general society. They're mm-hmm. better than they're protected. And I mean, somebody stuffs a pistol in a pair of sweatpants and goes out dancing, doesn't think that the law, doesn't think about the law. So his friend puts the gun in the glove compartment and doesn't turn it in, doesn't think that the law applies to him. And then the football team says, wait a minute, he didn't do anything wrong. There's so many examples where athletes are protected by the company that hires them that after a while I almost can't blame them for thinking we're different. On the other hand, I have to say, I meet a lot of athletes in, you know, particularly baseball and other sports that I cover, and the number of athletes who get it, who are part of society, and I could name, I mean, just strictly on African-American level, Derek Jeter and Curtis Granderson, Dontrell Willis, CC Sabathia. I mean, these are classy American athletes who do get it on a broader sense. So I don't think it's 100%, but certainly the system is working against it.
This is clearly a discussion that is going to be going on really for a very long time, and I want to thank you both for being with us. Leonard Moore from Austin, Texas, professor of history at the University of Texas, and George Vesey with the New York Times. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thanks again.